Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Donna Fishzahn, and today I have the privilege of speaking with Gohar Hamayunpour about her beautiful book, Doing Psychoanalysis in Tehran. It was published by MIT Press in 2012, and it won the 2013 Gradiva Award given by the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. Dr. Hamayunpour is a practicing psychoanalyst in Tehran. She trains and supervises the psychoanalysts of the Freudian group of Tehran and is a lecturer of psychoanalysis at Shahid Beshti University, Tehran. She earned her doctoral degree in 2006 from the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, where the orientation is modern psychoanalytic. After graduating, she returned to her native Iran. So in addition to doing psychoanalysis in Tehran, she has published articles in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, the Canadian Journal of Psychoanalysis, and the Freud Museum Journal. Gohar, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you. Actually, about a month ago, Gohar spent 2 weeks at Duke University, where I currently hold a postdoc in women's studies, and she gave three like fantastic, really just enchanting lectures on one on psychoanalysis and the veil, another about her book, and a third on geographies of psychoanalysis, which is an IPA research group founded by Lorena Preta. And as I understand it, it promotes a study related to the development of psychoanalysis in places where it's currently not widespread and not really institutionalized. And the project aims to investigate how psychoanalysis exerts cultural influence, but also the ways contact with various cultures and religions changes both the theory and practice of psychoanalysis. So it's like a two-way street. So I want today to focus on the book. Is that right? Did I summarize that?
Yes. Okay. It's a project that, as you said, was founded by the passion and intellectual force of Lorena Preta, and it's really been a privilege for me to be part of that because it's been one of the most fascinating projects. And I think what I particularly like about the project of Geographies of Psychoanalysis is that it stays away from a cultural relativist point of view, which I think a lot of times has been associated with cultural studies or anything one does with culture.
Boy, okay. I want to ask you more about that, and I hope we'll have a little bit of time. I mean, I want to focus on the book today, but if we have time, I definitely, or if the opportunity arises, you know, in the course of our discussion,
yes.
I hope we talk more about it. So
yes. And I also have to say about being at Duke that it was one of the most delightful experiences I've had in a long time. I really enjoyed being there with all of you, and it was really an irresistible experience.
Oh, for us as well. We're still talking about it. Thank you so much. About the book, I wanted to say something about the structure. It has a really interesting structure. At least for me, it was great. The first, there's like a first longer section, which is sort of a memoir, one could say, or I mean, you can characterize it too. It's a chain of associations even. And then the second shorter part is a series of clinical vignettes. And And then both parts are about really your clinical practice in Tehran. And there's also a lovely foreword by Abbas Kiarostami, who's, you know, famous, as we know, our audience might know, the famous Iranian filmmaker. So please tell us about the genesis. Let's just begin by talking about the genesis of the book, how it, you know, how you got the idea for the book, maybe. And perhaps you can say something about the hybridized generic form of it.
You know, and it's interesting because a lot of people ask this question because of the specific form the book has, which I think is, in a way, unique. And I write because I must, so which has also been a handicap, I have to say. Sorry, it's not that. You know, I can be one of those people that I admire a lot of times that can say, I will write 3 hours a day today. I can never write like that. And as I said, that has not been the, you know, the best way to produce a lot. But therefore, when I write, it's to work through something. It comes out of a place internally that it's a necessity. And I think that gets translated into the format of the book, which, as I say in the book, it takes the form of an analytic session. Or as I say, that is a note to myself. So is the art of the novel. And, you know, Chris Deva mentions this, and I mention in the book that in writing a novel that one comes closest to facing oneself. And, you know, I think when one writes scientific papers, as we all have, and we all have written doctorate dissertations, and not to take away from the importance of such projects, of course, but I think because I think those are necessary. But I think there's something else that happens when you write a novel, or you write in the way that I write, that I have written this book. So, in a sense, for me, it comes from a place to work through something, and it takes the form of an analytic session.
Is that part of why you chose Kiarostami to write the foreword? Or, I mean, what is the meaning? What meaning does he give for you or to your book? And because you could have chosen an analyst or somebody, I don't know, just somebody different. Is it because you wanted to stress the creative aspects of this book?
Yes, absolutely. I think that a lot of times, I think I mentioned this when I was at Duke, that a lot of times I find that non-analysts do more interesting things with psychoanalytic theories than analysts do. that for me has always been a space that I like to play in, you know, which is a space that, again, not to take away from the importance of a lot of analytic work that has been done by brilliant psychoanalysts. But for me, it becomes a space to play when I play with literature, when I play with cinema, when I play with philosophy. It becomes this sort of playground. And I think Kiarostami, that I'm a big fan of his cinema. And so, you know, all of these things put together, it was a privilege for me when he read the book and he was willing to do the foreword. It was important for me, for a non-analyst, to write the foreword. I think there is a message in it that's very close to my heart.
It was a beautiful foreword. You know what else was beautiful? That the cover, is beautiful, I should say, and people who purchased the book will see that. So when I first saw this book, actually, at my local bookstore in New York about 6 months before I met you, and I was immediately drawn to it, and I was thumbing through it, and the salesperson came up to me and said, it's a great book. You should, you know, because it's unusual for her. But it's at my local bookstore, right? It's like a, anyway, so on the cover, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the cover. It's a striking photograph of your very modern office. I don't know how else to put it.
Yes.
There's like a bookshelf prominently featured. It's a huge bookshelf. And this like sleek leather couch, also prominently featured, which I really like. It looks very inviting couch. And then beyond it, or behind it, there's a through a large window we see Tehran, or a part of it that, and it's interesting because it's a, to my eye, and I don't know Tehran at all, but it looks like not the central part, but maybe something is under construction sort of in the background too, because there's a mountain, but there's also buildings, and then it looks like there's a crane, but I could be completely making that up. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the cover and why you chose that particular photograph. If you can.
Well, that's a photo of my office. You know, it's the real deal. So I thought that, and you know, I think MIT Press produces the most beautiful books. I mean, I think it's been a privilege to, you know, to have them as my editor. And I always loved the way they produce these books. I think when we talk about the body of literature, in their case, we're really talking about the body of the book. So, you know, I loved getting these MIT Press books before they published my book, and, you know, to just look at that. And, you know, I think my publisher decided to produce, you know, it's a small book, and he decided to also produce it in a format that is small, which I think it really conveys the message of the book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the image is the image of my office. You mentioned that it's modern, and I think that's done purposefully in a sense, because as I talk about in the book, I try to stay away from this orientalist ideas of what it's like to do psychoanalysis in Iran. So I think it's important for me to have this very modern office, while you know, it's clearly when you see, as you mentioned through the window, a very typical image of Tehran.
I see. You're right, and I think the size. So the book is object, right? It's a small book, and then you see, and it's dominated. The cover is dominated by this picture of your office, and it's very inviting. It's like a come inside my office, and I'll tell you. It's an invitation to intimacy. It's very nice.
Yeah.
So, actually, you mentioned orientalizing images, and in your preface to the you say that. Audiences had a fascinated, you call it a fascinated rejection. Is that from Kristeva, perhaps? I forgot.
Yes. Yeah. That I am borrowing her term. Yeah.
I love it. But so that initially, I don't love the reaction, but I understand this reaction. That audiences had a fascinated, they were rejecting it, but in a fascinated way. They expected something, in other words, from the book, that it wasn't giving them. And it seems like what you're saying is, like the publishers, journalists, colleagues, whoever, they searched in the book for the sort of, for lack of exotic Iranian subject or something, or the trauma of the Eastern other. And they were sorely disappointed because it seems like the book really resists gratifying this, you know, resists this project of like tearing off the veil and revealing the other's otherness, you know, and you state very plainly that, you know, you say pain is pain and human beings are the same everywhere. And you know, the other strangeness is located in oneself. And yet, I guess my question, like, how does one write about doing psychoanalysis in Tehran without relying on cultural difference, you know, to some degree to articulate that experience, right? So I guess I was hoping you would talk about that, because a cultural difference is addressed in the book, and it's done primarily, well, it's done, yes, I would say even primarily through, or to some degree through Ms. N, who is this analysand that you reference a lot. And sometimes I think your voice and her voice seem to almost merge, or mm-hmm. I feel like she, I suspected at times that she was ventriloquizing you or that she was functioned mm-hmm. in this way. But this could be my fantasy about it. But please comment on mm-hmm. on this problem of, you know, cultural difference versus universalist sort of, project. You talk about, mm-hmm. for example, Oedipus, the Oedipus complex, and how you believe mm-hmm. in its universality. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me go back to the beginning of your question, because you talk about this fascinated rejection that I'm using, that, you know, I'm borrowing Kristeva's term. I think that in general, as a psychoanalyst, I don't believe that there's ever a fascination that is not accompanied by a rejection or vice versa. I think that the, you know, fascination is in the territory of rejection and vice versa. And, you know, this, you know, you smoothly go into this idea of Orientalism that is an idea that's very close to my heart. But I go beyond Edward Said and I say that he couldn't even envision the Orientalism that we're dealing with today. And I call it a hyper-Orientalism.
Wow.
This is also where another reason that I think Kiarostami was willing to write the foreword, because we agree on this, worldview that pain is pain everywhere. And that, in this sort of, for a lack of better word, for the just universal human condition, that we all die, that we all get old, that we all lose the people we love, that we all have to deal with separation, mm-hmm. and as we know. That our bodies fail us, and I mean, I don't want to be particularly pessimistic. It's evening for me, but I know it's morning for you, so I'm going to take it easy. But I think what I would like to add to Edward Said and this idea of Orientalism, or what I have called hyper-Orientalism, which is that I like to bring this time the responsibility of the Orientals in. I'm a psychoanalyst. For me, subjectivity is intersubjectivity. Mm-hmm. And it's always within a dialectic of desire. So it's not enough for me to say, let's blame the West for this Orientalism. I need to look beyond that. And I need to say that what is the Oriental doing in creating this Orientalism? Hmm. And I'm a firm believer that at the same time, this Oriental other is so attached to this exotic self, to this image of exoticness. And at some level, she or he has to come face to face with our inevitable ordinariness. And because of that, as we all know, it's not so easy to do, I think it becomes so seductive to become part of this dialectic of desire, of this Western other. But we play our part. Let me give you an example. I have an artist friend that mm-hmm. I always have these discussions with her, and she said to me, but I know exactly what the market wants of me, and I produce it and it sells in the West. I am playing in order to achieve my goals. But this is exactly what I have, there's a problematic within this discourse. There is a symptomatology that she's not seeing, which is, but in the process of this, you're basically losing the originality of your art, because you're becoming you're producing what the other wants you to produce. It's a master-slave mentality. Yes. And in a master-slave mentality, there is really no space to be negotiated for creativity. But she does, she has this idea that she's doing this with subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, becomes very dangerous, because that's not the case. Mm-hmm. You have to become face to face with your inevitable ordinariness, that there's nothing strange or exotic about you, that there's nothing particularly special about your Iranianness, for example. But I would, it's very important for me to go into something else you're asking, which is, well, then how do you write about doing psychoanalysis in Tehran? Mm-hmm. But I think, this is again where geographies of psychoanalysis as a project becomes endearing to me, which is I really believe in the universality, for example, of the Oedipus complex. I really believe in the universality of human conditions. But, of course, it goes without saying that the culture becomes a significant sort of, in a sense, these things are culturally differently elaborated.
Right.
So I don't like to be a cultural relativist, but I'm a firm believer that actually, first and foremost, you have to highlight the fact that we are similar as human beings in order to really be able to talk about culture. Hmm. I think actually you lose culture when you become a cultural relativist because it becomes redundant. But for me, actually, as I think it is in Kiarostami's cinema, culture is very much highlighted. How can it not be? I think that goes without saying. I think all I like to communicate in the book or with these different positions that I take is that actually it's the other way around. We have to start from this place that we all have this unconscious that we're terrified of, that therefore we project it into the other, that the stranger within ourselves, again to borrow Kristeva, is really the unconscious. It is our fear of the woman, is our fear of femininity, is our fear of death. And then from that place, I can talk about what it culturally means, or how is the Oedipus complex culturally elaborated within the Iranian culture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I understand so much what you're saying. Well, I think I understand, and I'm relating it, I have to admit, because I study Russia, and so
yeah.
I think Russian identity, you know, plays with this too. Are they part of East or West? But also a kind of self-orientalization. Like all you have to do is look at the Ballet Russe at the turn of the 20th century in Paris and see what they did to themselves. And I mean, it was a creative project. There was a lot of creativity in it, but it's clear that this is the dynamic you were referring to is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And also, yeah, I like your idea very much. I like this of taking maybe biology or the unconscious as axiomatic and working from there, and then seeing how culture then what culture does. But having this kind of axiom in the background or positing this real to use a Lacanianism perhaps. So keeping in mind maybe that we're not talking about, of course, essences, and we're not trying to participate in this kind of hyper-orientalization. I mean, you do. There is cultural difference that's often addressed in the book, and it's constituted through various kind of. It's constituted in various ways. So one way is in discussions or through discussions of temporalities. This is something that interests me as well, of East and West and how people approach time or experience time differently, for example, in Tehran and Paris. Okay, I'll pick Paris because it figures in the book. And you quote from Salman Akhtar.
You're picking up my unconscious when you pick up Paris. Go ahead.
Okay. Maybe it's not in the book. I just decided Paris. You quote from Salman Akhtar's book, Immigration and Identity, I believe. And I just wanted to read this quote because I don't know, it was very appealing to me. So for the East, relatively speaking, past, present, and future merge into one another. For the West, they are discrete entities. For the East, experience and time is like water collected in a pool, stagnant perhaps. For the West, time is more like water flowing in a stream. And one is acutely aware that what flows away forever. And I mean, it sounds, there's some cliche, but there's also, you know, real truth in it. And it's really about the structures of these societies and the cultures that that create these experiences, I think, of time. And can you comment a little bit about that and how this figures in the book or how this figures in your practice, if at all?
Yeah, I think these ideas of time and space, geography, history, you know, these are all negotiated differently within different, socio-political, socio-cultural realms. So I agree with you in that sense. I think what my, the last 8 years of work has shown me in Tehran is that I find that, for example, it's the past that is eroticized. in Iran, and I would say a bit in the East, I find, from reading, you know, about the East. While I would say it is the future that is eroticized in the West, you know, I would again say especially North America, because I think, you know, I would say that we're in Iran, we're one of our important philosophers, Dariush Shaiban, says that we breathe in the air of regret in countries like Iran. And I think that beautifully elaborates what I want to say about this eroticization of the past in countries like Iran.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I mean, I don't know about Russia, but I think it could fit into this description, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That there is this, you know, at least in the literature, in the Russian literature, I see this nostalgia, or this sort of eroticization of the past. I think so. I would say that here we're haunted by shadows. Well, I would say the West is haunted by this excess of images of the future, which, again, maybe we could even, I mean, these are just hypotheses, you know, but maybe we can even go as far as saying that, therefore, there is a negotiation between depression in the East and anxiety in the West. But, you know, none of these things is well researched or well thought about. It's just ideas that are coming up as I'm speaking with you. But I think so when we talk about temporality, this idea of past and the future, you know, these are culturally, of course, stuff that can we can say. This doesn't mean that I don't believe with every single patient that I work, these things doesn't become about the person's specific narrative and their intrapsychic dynamics.
Right. Yes. Well, yes. But I do like your questions very much, though. These are questions that I think about a lot. What do you think happens to the present? So if it's the future or the past is eroticized, where's the place of the present?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. But
well, it just came to me. I wasn't going to, but, you know, it sort of begs the question.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think if we think of time as this linear, linear thing, then we get into trouble with Heidegger when he's, you know, when he says that when we think about the present, it's just vulgar. So I don't know, but I think that maybe it gets lost somehow.
Right. It seems to, certainly in the U.S. context, I think the future is eroticized and politicized very much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this hyper, you know, this excess of images, I think.
Yes, yeah. Well, speaking of the sort of West and anxiety that you mentioned earlier, one of the things, the other difference that's highlighted, I guess one could say is between present day, like Iranian and American subjectivities, particularly, well, you know, this is a pet sort of, again, observation of mine, but you observe that Iranian and Alezans continue to resemble the Freudian patients, the classical patients.
Mm-hmm.
Your Alezans have no trouble in Tehran, have no trouble talking about sex, for example. In fact, sex dominates, and you see this in the second half of the book. It sort of dominates the sessions. They present Oedipal problems. You see many hysterics, you know, while in the States, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We hear, by contrast, we hear many analysts are all about, I mean, they're all but ready to relegate the neurotic to history. They're, certainly one can dispute this. And Lacanians, for example, do not subscribe to this. But I've heard it said often, and there's an increasing focus on the less than Oedipal. I think it's sometimes referred to these patients as less than Oedipal. So borderlines and narcissists who are seemingly filling the practices today of I guess New York practices. And I think on this very program, there was an analyst who called such patients pre-analytic.
Neurotic patients? with pre-analytic.
Pre-analytic. No, not neurotic. Mm. Sort of less than neurotic. So who's just sort of, I guess, weren't quite ready for analysis. I mean, that's the implication, right? So you had to sort of prepare them for that.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't just, for example, you know, go on the couch immediately and free associate, like, you state in the book that Tehranians have no problems doing this, or at least in your mm-hmm. practice, in your clinic. So I guess my question is, do you stick by this? Is there really a difference? And if there is, are the patients in the United States different, or is the difference located perhaps in the analysts and in the theory and diagnostic categories they employ?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's a cultural creation. You know, I think that it's the zeitgeist, you know, it's what the French would call the, you know, it's the spirit of our times, you know, l'air du temps. It's so I think the spirit of our time is that in the United States, I would say in North America, or in mainstream heteronormative analytic discourse, if I love to use heteronormative here. There is an omission of sex, and I don't think that's just within the analytic discourse. And this, of course, doesn't mean that we don't hear this, what Lacan would call an empty speech about sex. I think there's actually a reaction formation to this omission. So we hear this discourse that's full of this talk about sex, but it's really not about the erotic or sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an omission of sex, I think, from mainstream heteronormative discourse in general, not only within the analytic discourse, but of course the analytic discourse is part of this. You know, it becomes part of this mainstream heteronormative discourse. How can it not be? It's not happening in a vacuum, the analytic discourse.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, we hear, you know, look at all these TV shows in North America, look at all the books, you know, whatever 50 Shades of Grey, I forget how many Shades of Grey, but something like that. You know, it's like, is that really about sex? Is it really the popularity of it? Is it about sex? I don't think so. I think it's about pornography, which, as we all know, has nothing to do with sexuality. Pornography has nothing to do with sexuality. So in a sense, it's not about the erotic. It's about this reaction formation to this omission of sex, which I think is a general problematic, and it's in a sense a symptomatology of the spirit of our times. It's a diagnosis criteria of our times. But if we want to more specifically look at the analytic discourse, I think there has been, you know, the same omission, as I say, it has happened, and we see within the analytic literature, every analytic journal you pick up, you know, Andre Green had this famous paper, Where Has Sex Gone in Psychoanalysis? Or we hear, you know, where have all the hysterics gone? Suddenly we do not have any more hysterics, or we must call them pre-analytic. I'm not sure. So I think that then when I talk about finding that, you know, I wrote a small response to Andre Green's paper saying I found it in Tehran, you know,
right.
Because this is where it had, but this is where it has gone. Because I think that there is a reminiscent of the era of, you know, of the Oedipus Rex in Tehran, that you hear a lot of patients, and this was also a surprise to me, are more comfortably talking about, their Oedipal issues, their sexuality, about, we see a lot more his, you know, it's very much nostalgic, I think, of Freud's Vienna, you know.
Right.
And again, maybe I can give you an example, because
I was teaching
Dora in my class last week, and Dora, you know, is one of the probably most famous patient of Freud. Right. And Dora, did you know that Freud lived in Berghasse 19, Dora lived in Berghasse 32.
It's not surprising.
Which is,
Yeah, okay.
Which is fascinating. Yeah. But that was l'air du temps of the spirit of that time, of psychoanalysis in its earlier years. This is not, you know, again, to go back to Paris, can one imagine such a thing in Paris nowadays between an analyst, the distance between an analyst and an analyst being symbolically between Berghaus and 1932? We can't, but in Tehran, we can. It happens all the time. Again, I'm using this as a symbolic metaphor of what I mean when I talk about that l'air du temps, the spirit of our times, of psychoanalysis, of doing psychoanalysis in Tehran today, is very much the way it was in Freud Vienna. And unlike what a lot of people has read this statement of mine, this mm-hmm. doesn't mean it's behind.
Right.
Again, we're mm-hmm. not talking about time in a linear way anymore, of mm-hmm. course. But that there is this, you know, it's that psychoanalysis is booming, all of this interest there is in it. There is all this desire. There is all the problematics that comes with the introduction of psychoanalysis and all this desire and all these various transferences. And there's very easily the possibility, literally and symbolically, of Berghaus 19 and Berghaus 32.
When you say actually that there's no sex in pornography, for example, and when you say that there's more sexuality within the discourse in Tehran, in the analytic discourse or in the analysand's discourse, or both. Mm-hmm. Are you really speaking? I mean, what is sex then, right? If it's not porn,
I really have to stay away from this topic. I'm sorry, okay. But I keep getting sorry.
That's okay. I was just thinking about desire. Yeah. How you would you're saying something about desire there, but mm-hmm. okay.
Well, yes. I'm definitely saying something about desire.
Okay.
Let me just give you an example and we can leave this topic.
Okay, yes.
I talk about Kundera in the book a lot.
I was going to ask you.
He's a master signifier for me.
Yes, he
and,
is.
You know, he had this critique of the American production of the movie of The Unbearable Lightness of Being. He said that it wasn't about the erotic, but it was pornographic, which is the opposite of the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, but we can.
Okay, well.
But I can happily move on to Kundera, if you wish.
Well, Kundera in a second. I wanted to actually speak about maybe something a little bit more innocuous, which is hospitality. So another sort of difference that's outlined or an experience that you had in your or had when you first returned to Tehran, certainly you dealt with these feelings of dislocation and maybe unbelonging, but also, I don't know, it seems that, well, you talk in an ambivalent sort of way maybe about all of the hospitality and friendship and intimacy that you experience there and how it's that you don't always experience in the West. Or maybe Ms. N, this analysand, talked about it, but you seem to assume part of this. You seem to take on part of her discourse a little bit here. And I don't know. Do you have maybe something to say about that, or maybe how
that actually? Yeah. I don't. Go ahead.
Or how she functions also in the book, because in addition to Kundera, so Kundera is there definitely, and he's a master signifier, as you put it.
Mm-hmm.
But so is she. She's really threaded through the first half of the first, you know, maybe even three quarters of the book. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think, you know, who is she? At first you described that you were a little bit intimidated by her, and then she becomes someone you kind of identify with at various moments, and she's a bit older than you, right? But there's clearly some kind of identification happening, or at least this is how I read it. Again, you could totally dispute it. So I thought, you know, there are these two figures basically in the book. There's Kundera and she's there, and I thought maybe you could talk about both of them, maybe in tandem or separately, and their function for you. I mean, so she seems to be the voice of this, like these sketching out. She seems to really trace these differences between East and West.
Mm-hmm. Well, she does it in a split form. No? She does it in a you know, it's a complete split for her. You know, at times these, of course, as we know, as when one splits, there's easily the switch can happen, you know, the good becomes the bad and the bad becomes the good. But she does it. And in this sense, I think it becomes, you know, because I'm convinced that when one writes about patients, one again is trying to work through a part of oneself. And I think for, you know, her, for me, she had this function of, you know, she was a woman. She was also recently returned to her motherland, if we want to call it, or fatherland at times. And so we were two women from different generations. There was this transgenerational idea that I like, and you know, I work with a lot within the room. You know, Dr. Stefano Bolognini, you know, beautifully writes about this transgenerational idea that shouldn't be forgotten in the room. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was this transgenerational idea. These two women, both recently returned, who were struggling with these ideas of belonging and unbelonging. And, you know, as I think Ranjana Khanna speaks beautifully about this idea of belonging and unbelonging, you know, psychoanalytically, if we want to look at it, the idea very much in the book is an idea of unbelonging, which is absolutely not the idea of non-belonging. It's different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the idea that we see actually within the Freudian discourse a lot about pleasure, unpleasure, and, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that the idea, again, if we want to look at it from a Freudian discourse, it's the discourse of regression in a way. You know, when you regress to a place, it's a place you have already been. It's not a new place. Therefore, it's regression. This is the economic theory of libido. You know, you have gone somewhere, and then because of certain things, the fixations, you know, certain triggers in the outside world, you make this regression to a place that you have already been. In a sense, you make a regression to your motherland. You regress to this place, and then you have to struggle because it's not a place you don't belong to, and it's not a place you belong to. And a process of unbelonging, which I always, you know, every time I say unbelonging, I want to say unplugging, because I think there's also an unplugging that happens when you do, you know, through the process of unbelonging. So it's a place that it's a familiar territory. And again, going to the idea of fixation, it's not only familiar, it has an extensive amount of affective energy associated to it.
Yeah.
So it's not even a normal place that you just go back and visit. It's, you know, it's sort of, you know, I can't, you know, this has become my professional deformation, that I can't help but go back to the words that we have been saying, which is, in a sense, you know, one regresses to Paris, or I often regress to Paris, which is a place that I was born there and spent 0 to 5 there.
Oh, I didn't realize. Interesting. Okay, so it's Paris. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I'm originally from the Soviet Union, which mm-hmm. you know, that's complicated more. A country that doesn't no longer exist. So this regression is then it's also vanishing. I think this place that I used to go back to, that I still go back to, but it's no longer the same. So, we'll leave that. And Kundera, you were going to speak about Kundera a little bit. And how he functions.
You know, a lot of people have asked me, how come Kundera takes so much space? And I want to say, staying very true to this discourse of revealing and hiding and revealing and hiding, because one does both simultaneously, of course, as one speaks. But staying true to this discourse, I have to say, I want to say to them, how can he not, if you read the book? Kundera is a symbolic representation of my father.
Yeah.
And, you know, my father was the translator of his works into Farsi, and I read Unbearable Lightness of Being when I was 13. And Kundera becomes so much part of this narrative because his name falls upon my father's name. And, you know, in a sense, would Unbearable Lightness of Being at 13 affect me the way it did if my father wasn't a Farsi translator. Now, this doesn't take away from the fact that I think Unbearable Lightness of Being is the art of the novel at its highest. But still, this incredible, irresistible, delicious book would have affected, would have taken so much psychic space for me. I'm not sure. So I think I didn't have a choice but for Kundera to take so much space within this within a book that is autobiographical in a way.
Yeah, I mean, so you do reveal this in the book, and I was about to say it, but I thought I would let you talk about your father and the relationship between Kundera and your father. You know, but I also read I didn't read it at 13. Maybe I'm a little older than you. I read it at, I don't know. I was a teenager, but older. And it had a big effect on me as well. But again, I'll leave my personal narrative aside for a second.
Yeah.
What was I going to say about that? I was wondering about the novel, though, and I'll ask it a slightly different question because, you know, clearly the very name Kundera is already, you know, bears this importance and this symbolic weight because of your father. But you do kind of weave in, I mean, there are certain maybe lessons one could say. I mean, did it help? Was Unbearable Lightness of Being somehow, did you keep thinking of it or thinking about those scenarios when you were practicing in those, when you first came back to Tehran? And does it still have a bearing?
Well, I think there's
on
very
your
much that,
yeah.
I think again we go back to what you were saying before about belong. I think there is an unbelonged anti-hero in Kundera that my father probably found extremely desirable, as I did. Again, going through this transgenerational idea, I think there is an odyssey. There is Odysseus that I also talk about in the book, taking from Kundera's other book, you know? So I think there is I think we share this anti-hero, unbelonged character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well,
Which maybe goes a little bit also into what you were asking about hospitality, no? Because then... Yes. The question of hospitality becomes important to such characters. hospitality, friendship, hospitality, you know, borrowing. It's, for me, these signifiers come hand in hand with the different signifiers, which a lot of times is not mentioned with them. But for me, it's it automatically becomes part of the chain of that signifier, and it's gratitude. I think that Melanie Klein's paper, my favorite paper of Melanie Klein, is, you know, From Envy to Gratitude. And this, again, is one of the things that has become particularly highlighted for me living in Iran, because I think there is... there's something to, you know, I'm working on this. This is one of my projects, but there's something to be said about this being particularly culturally highlighted in Iran. But I think when one moves from envy to gratitude, one develops a psychic space for hospitality, for friendship, you know, in this, and a sort of, I think, above all, a certain intimacy, maybe. Maybe that's the best word for it. But I think when one doesn't work through from envy to gratitude, that becomes a space that never gets opened. And of course, I'm not talking. I mean, I hope that I'm clear that this is not a humanitarian approach at all. Mm-hmm. I take a stand against that. It's about. Movement. It's about opening up psychic space. It's about at the end, maybe about knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, I think I know what you mean. I think I know what this reaction is about to do humanitarianism, but maybe can you just elaborate that a little bit on that?
Well, I think Freud was not a humanist.
No.
And I think I adhere to that discourse. Mm-hmm. As a Freudian, I adhere to that discourse. I think that, you know, he says, you know, there is no such thing as any sort of altruistic behavior. You know, mm-hmm. we don't do anything for the other because we're this wonderful, self-sacrificing people. We do things because it has some psychic meaning for us.
Mm-hmm.
We do things because it has psychic function for us. This, of course, doesn't mean that I don't think people can be, for example, develop these capacities for friendship, intimacy, and gratitude. Of course, I believe that. But of course, we do that in the name of something higher than humanism. You know, humanism, I think a lot of times, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say these things so publicly, but, you know, I have a compulsion to confess all the time that gets me in trouble. But I think there's a sadism that gets, it's hidden behind this sort of humanism.
Mm-hmm. That's because there's always behind guilt that accompanies it as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's guilt. There's your own anxieties. You know, this is not happening out of desire, to go back to desire. This is happening out of a limitation, out of something that you have not developed the capacity for.
Right. Yeah, and that's very true. I mean, that's something I agree
with. I think humanism, to use the Lacanian discourse, is right. within the realm of jouissance and not that of desire.
Well, thank you for invoking Lacan, because I was just about to, but I thought we were very much entering that discourse, but it's a mm-hmm. Freudian one. I mean, it's a continuity from what Freud says in, you know, whatever civilization mm-hmm. is discontents, you know, you can just mm-hmm. pick a mm-hmm. text, really. Well, we've taken up enough of your time, I think, but I wanted to ask you before we go about your current projects, actually, and maybe you can tell us something about Geographies of Psychoanalysis or something else you're working on, or the Freud group, or your writing projects.
Well, I have, you know, I'm the founder and director of the Freudian Group of Tehran that we established 8 years ago, and it's a very dear project to me.
Mm.
It's as anybody who has done any sort of institutionalized work knows that it comes with its own set of struggles and it has particularly been difficult this year. But I think that we have wonderful, desirous people that are willing to symbolically stand at its door and protect it. And I'm very happy to be part of this sort of odyssey with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that it has been part of doing a psychoanalysis in Tehran. So that is an ongoing project that I'm very proud of, and I have the privilege to work with all these people and be part of it, because it's really the members that make the group, and you know, I'm just one person who had the desire for this, but it's because of their desire that it keeps going and it keeps moving. I'm working on my next book, I don't talk about the book when I'm writing it because it's not conducive for me to continue writing it, but I can give you the title.
Wonderful. Anything we can get from
that
you.
That is a fantasy title. It might not end up being the title, but we had the Geographies of Psychoanalysis conference in October here in Tehran.
Oh, okay.
We had wonderful people coming from all over the world, from Argentina, India, Italy, everywhere, you know, Vienna. And so Mariano Horenstein, who came here from Argentina, they went to Isfahan for a couple of days, and when they were back from Isfahan, very impressed and delighted by Isfahan, I said to him, "Did you see the Isfahan is famous for the blue, for the color blue mm-hmm. of the city." And he said, "Yes, it was really breathtaking." And then I started telling him about some of the recent struggles of doing psychoanalysis in Tehran and about this book that I'm working on and I don't have a particular title for. And he said, "Maybe you should call it Persian blues, which I really, really like. So that for now is the going title. I haven't had a better idea because I think it plays with the idea
right.
of blues.
It's and, very playful.
And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. it's very playful, yes. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's, you know, and one always has a lot of different papers that is, you know, one is working on and, you know, more academic papers. But books I write within the same writing style that the first book has been, you know, and these things.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess we should wrap up. Thank you. Thanks very much again for doing this. I've been talking to Gohar Hamayunpour about her fantastic book, Doing Psychoanalysis in Tehran. And thanks. It was a great pleasure. And thanks to our audience for listening. Till next time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was really fun.